and it was a packed house. And we did the presentation, and all the farmers want it. They love it, right? But they couldn't understand why they had this stupid TUA attached to it, and they couldn't keep their seed. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of it, we're like, if you don't like that, then don't use it. But we want it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We hired ex-RCMP people that were retired, and they policed the technology use agreement.
That would have been tense.
It was pretty tense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then 2012, I start back up in, it was like the first week of July, right after the July long weekend. And we're in the boardroom, and Gary's like, well, guys, we got a drought. We're going to have to cut back. We're, you know, anytime a drought happens, it's about an 18-month hit to our business. Mm-hmm. You know, start cutting expenses, cutting everything. And I'm like, oh my God, what have I gotten myself?
Good timing.
Welcome to the Flamin Connect podcast, where we share real stories, experiences, and insights from people who know agriculture today and care where it's going in the future. Okay, so how much does a farmer get paid for the durum used to make an average serving of pasta?
Not enough.
Yeah, well, you covered all the multiple choice. So.
How much does the farmer get paid
for the durum used in an average serving of pasta?
Oh. Well, no, I'll figure this out. This would be pretty easy.
An average serving of pasta.
Okay,
would be how
so
much?
Like today, what's durum worth today? Call it $8 a bushel?
Give or take, yeah.
Okay, so a bushel's a 5-gallon pail.
Yep.
The amount of durum you need to make like a serving of pasta would be. Oof. Of a bushel?
I've never made pasta before, so I have no idea how much.
It's flour. Yeah. It's flour.
Just grind it.
So, a bushel would make a lot of pasta. So just wait. No, we can figure this out. This
is like 10%, 5%?
No, man, I think like, yeah. Yeah,
a bushel?
Like, I'm thinking like 5% of that 5-gallon pail, right? Units of measurement, a 5-gallon pail. Yeah. It's a bushel-ish.
Yeah,
okay.
Ish, yeah.
So, for easy figuring, if we cut that pail in tenths, let's go 10%. So then that would make.
That'd make it 8 cents.
Yeah. Initially, when you asked the question, say, I don't know, like a penny. Mm. So, okay. Yeah.
I think 10% is a high number if you take a look at a bushel.
So do I, man. That's a ton.
I'm going to say, like, we're talking 4 cents.
Okay.
I'm going to go with one. Yeah. I'm going to go with my original, how I felt, like a penny.
Yeah, you guys are actually right in the neighborhood. So I won't even give you the multiple choice because you're right there. It's about 5 cents. Ooh. It's about 5 cents, yeah. So it depends on, of course, what the prices are, which fluctuate quite a bit. But assuming a farmer gets paid $10 a bushel.
Oh, see, that's why I was low. See this?
Now, this is according to the National Association of Wheat Growers in the U.S. The flour from one bushel of durum makes about 42 pounds of pasta. That's about 210 servings. So each serving would be just about 5 cents worth of durum.
So we're close. Had we had been at $10 instead of $8, we would have been bang on.
Yeah.
We would have been right
on the money. Yeah. Good job.
Ah. Look at me. You guys know how smart I feel. Sometimes Trevor asks me simple questions and I'm in left field. Yeah. The dumb guy.
Okay, let's jump into our info session. Today, Jonathan Stratton, our Senior Manager for Aftermarket, is going to share some new and innovative products that serve our customers better.
What's something that the Aftermarket team is working on right now that excites you?
So right now, the past, almost past year now, it's been in development, and now we released it at Ag and Motion, or not Ag and Motion, it was Ag Business Connect, was the fire suppression skid. Developed here. It's a 150-gallon capacity skid that was designed first off to go onto the back of a J&M grain cart to help fight fires if they arise in the field. So customers have a solution with them everywhere they're going when they're harvesting.
Do they just fit J&M carts?
So as we were
That's how it started. J&M carts.
So
okay.
There are some options to adapt them to some other carts. It's usually on those corner unload carts. We can get them to fit on the back end if you have a bottom drag cart. J&M has some. It's a little bit more of a challenge to get them fit on. But we also came up with, well, how do we make this just not available for fall application, but there's lots of fires in the spring. So we reframed it to also fit in the back of a half ton. It's got skid slots on it, so you can pick it up with a forklift or your pallet forks at the farm and kind of add some diversity to it. I know lots of guys just have it that have bought them, have it in the back of their half ton. Some have it on the grain cart. Lots of other people kind of have like stuff we build here in house. We'll sell a flat deck or a car haul or trailer. Then we're selling a bigger slip tank to go on the trailer. Guys are putting a toolbox on it. So they're kind of building their own kind of mobile shop support units in the field. I know you can buy them all in one from certain manufacturers, but guys are building them. I've seen guys have started to put this as another accessory on that unit because that fuel and tool trailer goes everywhere. So we're going to put that fire suppression unit on there to go to the field with it.
Is that why they're gas powered? So they're not running off the hydraulics of the cart, like, yes. So they're portable, or is there other options there?
For kind of to make them a little bit more diverse, gas power and the simplicity of gas. I know it does come though. You know, if it's sitting all winter, it's just like any gas engine, you know, your lawnmower sits in the shed all winter. You're going to want to bring it out. You want to fire it up. You want to make sure it's tuned up and ready to go to for the season, like any gas engine. We have been tinkering around with some hydraulic options for guys that want it only on their grain cart. I think we're close to getting a hydraulic drive option. The first kick at the can, the pump we had wasn't big enough to provide the pressure we desired with the unit, but I think now we have a solution. So look for that to come down. Again, that's, you know, we talked about, you know, customer-inspired Flamin-built products or Flamin-assembled products, I guess I could say in this case. We do have an ask for that, so we're going to try and meet that hydraulic drive, especially for customers that just want it on their grain cart. So really excited about this. I think we've produced almost 100 now. I think there's 70 went out the door already. So
wow.
It's been a big uptick. When we initially started to design it, it was designed for the ag market. We've seen a big uptick on municipalities have taken them just to have them at hand. We've even had some small town volunteer fire departments have them as secondary support, especially in small towns. Quite often you're going out to a field fire in the spring, like after there was a fire yesterday in PA. You can't get to the fire, so to be able to put it in the back of a half ton or the back of a small trailer and tow it out gives you a lot closer access rather than just physically fighting the fires with shovels or rakes or leaf blowers or whatnot. So really excited about this product. I think there's a ton of applications everywhere in the last few years. Like, thank God we got some rain here. That's going to be great for the beginning of seeding, but it can dry up very quickly here. And I think it's something small enough in a convenient package that can provide a lot of safety in all types of aspects, ag and construction and regional parks. We've had campgrounds buy them to have, right? You got campfires going all over. Can't wait for the fire department to come. Fire extinguisher only goes so far. Like RVs have a fire extinguisher, but to have something sitting on a trailer or a truck close by with 150 gallons of water, it is equipped with foam cartridge. So that basically what that foam cartridge is doing is it just allows that water to go a lot farther. So that water creates a foam that helps suppress that fire. And so then it almost, I think, don't misquote me, but I think you can get almost up to 10 times the capacity.
That was my number. Yeah,
I think it's 10 times.
10x, yeah.
Yeah, 10x the capacity of water. So it's a 180-gallon unit, but you put the foam in it. So maybe you can get similar to 1,000 gallons of water, right? So. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Thanks, Jonathan. Now it's time to introduce our special guest for today's episode. Our special guest segment is from an interview that we did at this year's Ag Business Connect event in Regina. So let's head over there now. We are joined today by Paul Breezebaugh, the Senior Vice President of Ag Growth International. Welcome.
Thanks, Trevor.
So, Paul, where did you grow up? Where are you from?
I grew up in Saskatoon, born and raised. Then from there, We had family that farmed out in the Arborfield, Tisdale area, mm-hmm. Shabbats.
Mm-hmm.
And so had a bit of a farm connection there.
Yep.
But just grew up in Saskatoon, played hockey, played baseball.
Yeah. Athlete as a kid?
You could say that a little bit. Yeah. I tried to be an athlete. ended up playing junior hockey in Nipawin, Saskatchewan.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Played there for 4 years.
In the cage.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Welcome to the jungle. Oh, Flin Flon's a little more of a jungle than Nipawin.
It's actually it's one of the further south teams in that division, if you can believe it.
Yeah, exactly.
Flin Flon and LaRange in the same division.
Yeah.
What would be one of your first childhood memories?
Oh, that's a good question. First childhood memories. Well, I grew up in the north end in around Archibald Arena, if you can remember that, in Saskatoon. And probably my sister hauling my equipment to practice every day.
I was actually, in preparation for this, I was asked, like, do you think they had knitted sweaters when Paul played hockey? No. But the Rutherford rink definitely didn't have a roof on it back then. And then, anyway, so if you're...
Come on, the Rutherford rig had a roof on it. Please, come on.
So
we did have tube skates, though. Started with tube skates.
Really?
And then the Microns, if you guys, maybe you guys don't even remember that, Microns and Minaris.
Still listen here, what are tube skates?
Tube skates? So they got two tubes, right, on the bottom of the base of the skate, and then you have a blade. So rather than, I guess, the way a traditional or a skate is today, it was two tubes and then a blade.
Yep.
Yeah.
Would have been heavy as hell. I've never worn them myself.
What year is this in, Paul? I got to know. For my own sake, I got to know.
Let's just say the 70s.
Knocking on the door of knitted sweaters.
So digging into that a little bit, how many divisions were there in Saskatoon minor hockey at that time, and who did you play for?
I played for the Raiders.
Okay.
And I think there might have been like eight different divisions. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, we our group of kids, and this happens sometimes, we were quite good.
Yeah.
So in Bantam, we actually went to Western Canadians 2 years in a row.
Oh, wow.
That was pretty cool because Gordie Howe spoke at one of them and got to meet Gordie Howe and shake his hand.
Yeah.
And then Bobby Hull was at another one.
Yeah.
And got to shake his hand probably prior to when he was drinking too much. After, I think, the parents had more fun after with him.
So how do you remember that meeting, meeting Gordie Howe?
Oh, 100%.
So I've seen pictures of Gordie Howe when he was still living and he was, you know, fairly old. But I always go back when he passed away, there was this picture on the internet of him fishing and sitting in this big fishing chair and his biceps were just like Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
Was he that big of a dude?
You know what? He was older then, so he would have been probably 60 or so. He's
retired for 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. That's right. You couldn't tell. Like he was a big man.
Yeah.
But his hands were massive.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They just, you know, he wrapped right around my hand completely.
Yeah, I've heard that before. Actually, that's common for people to describe him that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just massive.
Yeah.
So progressed through hockey then. Did you play midget in Saskatoon then as well?
Played midget AAA.
Okay.
So played for the Blazers for a year.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then went to play as a 17-year-old up in Nipawin.
Billet? In
Billets,
what was that experience like?
It was awesome.
Yeah,
You know, that's second family. So you know, my wife actually, she's like, "Oh, you left, you know, home when you were 17." I'm like, "Yeah, I left home to go to a better home."
And really, not that far away. Really,
you're not that
two
far
and a half
away.
Hours. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was a great experience. And actually, that probably crystallized my love of agriculture because. My billet was Brian Hammerston and Gaylene, and they had Hammerston Holdings, which is an Esso dealership.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the spring, I would haul anhydrous fertilizer for them, and it was always fun hanging out with the farmers and getting to know the business.
Yeah, and this young hockey punk from Saskatoon's out delivering fertilizer and away you go.
Oh, yeah, they loved beating me up, right?
Absolutely.
They didn't know nothing about farming or anything, so...
Yeah, so you were delivering anhydrous for a local farmer. Was that your first introduction to agriculture then?
Yeah, Yeah, it was. Well, other than our family that farmed in the Tisdale area, we'd go out there and my dad would help out on the farm and I'd be there in the hauling in the grain truck and things like that. But, you know, other than that, the real experience was hauling anhydrous. And mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long did you do that for?
Well, when I went to university, I would come back after exams. And so for 4 years, I would go back and haul fertilizer for, it's usually about a 4 week window, mm-hmm. working 12 to, you know, 18 hour days. Because that's the time when farmers are busy and wanted to get things done. And it was good for me because it was like, you know, you just hang out, yep. haul fertilizer, yep. and it was fun. Yeah.
And make good money too.
Make good money, yeah.
What did you go to school for? You're a U of S guy.
I'm a U of S guy. Yeah. I went in commerce. I played Husky hockey as well mm-hmm. When I was there. And didn't really envision that I would have a career in ag, but... So I graduated in 96, and at the time there wasn't a lot of opportunities in Saskatoon. So it was like insurance companies, right? Working for Investors Group or something, Sun Life, something like that, which I was kind of, you know, mediocre on. And then I had an interview with Monsanto in Edmonton, and one was Xerox. And I met with the sales manager from Monsanto, and he was a good Saskatchewan guy, loved that I played hockey. Had good hockey hair at the time, we really hit it off, right? And I said, I don't really know who Monsanto is, but it sounds like a great job, right? He goes, you know what? The job is in, well, you were interviewing for Edmonton, but actually the job is in Peace River, Alberta. And I'm like, I don't know where Peace River is, but it sounds pretty awesome. So about 2 days later, they offered me the job and the rest is history. I started with Monsanto up in Peace River in Alberta. I didn't realize how far away it was.
Yeah. From a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Like everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's another world.
It is. It is. But it was a great experience and a great way to learn the business. Mm-hmm. I have fond memories of Peace River. I was only up there for about 20 months. But, you know, the dealers there were great, big farmers. So got to know a lot of the big mm-hmm. farmers up in the Peace. What they deal with is a short season. So just a little more pressure than maybe other farmers are dealing with. And I had a good mentor up there. So at the time, because I was a commerce guy, I wasn't an agronomist or anything. I had a mentor that taught me a lot about the agriculture side of business, weed identification, mm-hmm. things like that. The products that we sold at the time were Avidex and Roundup, and Avidex never worked. So I can
Avidex
remember.
Avidex in a granular?
A granular, right? And so in the spring, you would go and you'd be doing scrape backs, uh-huh. we call them, right? And looking at wild oats, the difference between wild oats and wheat.
Yeah.
And it's like a twist,
yeah.
right? And so learned that and, you know, would do the count on how many of the wild oats were dead and, you know, what 85% control looks like when a farmer's looking for 100%. So
that was back in the day when if a chemical didn't work, you called your chemical rep. That doesn't happen anymore. They go to the retailer now. The reps don't touch it anymore.
Oh, yeah. 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 No.
And you have the argument with the farmer.
It was product inquiries.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of product inquiries and you went out there and it was challenging. There were some times when, you know, in that first spring, I was like, what am I doing? Like I'm looking at wild oats and quack grass and I'm a commerce grad, made it through that, was resilient and there was a lot of opportunity on Monsanto at the mm-hmm. time. 1 year after we introduced Roundup Ready crops, Roundup Ready canola. Mm-hmm. And that was a very interesting time, particularly being up in the Peace.
And that took off like wildfire.
It did. Yeah. It did. I still have a great memory of being in Falher. And the way that we introduced Roundup Ready canola was it had a technology use agreement.
Yep.
And most of the farmers like to keep their seed and particularly up in the Peace River region. And here you couldn't keep the seed, right? Mm-hmm. And and we were in Flair, and the place was packed. We were in the top of a rink, and it was a packed house. And we did the presentation, and all the farmers want it. They love it, right? But they couldn't understand why they had this stupid TUA attached to it, and they couldn't keep their seed. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of it, we're like, if you don't like that, then don't use it. But we want it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So who policed, I'm going to dig into this, who policed the TUA in year two? How did, because I mean, you can go into, Percy Schmeiser was in my neck of the woods, right? Yeah. And you get into that conversation about who really owns the seed. But I mean, I fully understand both sides of the argument. But when it comes to the Peace Country and these guys are buying a bag of seed, they're paying $15 an acre for their TUA.
Yeah.
And they decide to just roll that into next year's seed.
Yeah.
Who is policing that?
Monsanto was.
Do they? Yeah. Are you?
No. So, okay. Well, at one point in time in my career with Monsanto, I was the Roundup Ready lead.
Yeah.
And the licensing part of that fell under me. Mm-hmm. And so we hired ex-RCMP people that were retired. And they policed the technology use agreement.
That would have been tense.
It was pretty tense.
Yeah.
And the reality of it, though, was there was a lot of farmers that were paying for it. Mm-hmm. And they said, if you're not going to police it, then I don't want to pay for it. So you better police it.
Yep.
And that's exactly what we did.
So how do you police that?
Well, there's a number of ways that you do it. And one is when you hear that people are selling seeds, right? It was like a sting operation. And so they would go out and make like they were buying the seed. And everything would be caught on camera and on
this is in the 90s.
Audio. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. So we might have to cut that. I don't know.
So, but when you sign this, is it not comparable to like organic crop inspections? Like, when you're signing up for the organic program that you get audited, like that's part of it.
It was different than that. So there was an actual tip line. So farmers would call us and say, hey, we think this guy's, been running his seed or selling seed.
And that would be coming from someone that's also paying.
That's right.
Well, because paying. It's diminishing why they're paying for their grain. For their seed.
Yeah, it's competitive for producers, right?
So Monsanto owns that patent. They own that genome that allows you to spray glyphosate on that product. And, if you're buying 10 bags and you're producing 40 bushels to the acre on that crop, who owns the seed or who owns the genome within the seed that you've produced moving forward? And that's the argument is, I produce the seed, that's my seed. Well, actually it has characteristics that you purchased from us that is now in your seat.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's you could see both sides of the argument.
Oh yeah.
The other side of that argument too is if companies aren't compensated for the research and development to get that product to that point, if they're just going to lose it to the open market, what incentive do companies have to put the research and development into making better products for producers to use?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And that helps propel the industry to hit other levels.
Yeah, Monsanto always got a bad rap, and they probably still do.
Yep.
Early
adopters.
Early adopters, innovators. Biotech was a massive innovation for agriculture and really changed the landscape of agriculture and canola for Western Canada.
Yep.
All of a sudden, it became a crop that you could grow and do it well. Mm-hmm. And so it was pretty cool to be on the front end of biotech with a big company like that.
Well, just, that's, what are we talking, 40 years now of Roundup Ready Canola, still very persistent today, right?
Yeah.
How did it proceed through Monsanto? How did that career take form to lead to other opportunities?
Yeah, so I was in sales to begin with, went into marketing, did many marketing roles in terms of marketing our Avidex and Sundance was a product that I got to launch. It's a Group 2 product herbicide. Ran the Roundup Ready franchise for a while in Canada. Mm-hmm. Ran the Roundup business in Canada. And then ultimately had a couple of opportunities to go to St. Louis and decided for personal reasons, for family reasons, that we wanted to stay in Winnipeg.
Yep.
And so decided to move and go to Richardson. And oh, yeah. A customer of ours, good mm-hmm. customer of Monsanto's, and so went on to that side of the business. Thought it was a great opportunity to work with family-owned business. Mm-hmm. At the time, they weren't the Richardson they are today.
Yeah.
They were smaller, yeah. much yeah. smaller, but had aspirations of being bigger. So it was a really neat opportunity. Mm-hmm. Worked with them on their traditional ag business from a marketing and sales perspective, and then moved on to the oilseed platform side of the business. And was a big part of getting the Yorkton facility approved by their board.
Oh, really?
In terms of location identification and, mm-hmm. and you know, the rationale as to why canola oil will be the next big oil
yeah.
globally.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that is we did the theoretical analysis on what we felt. We had a team that I was leading that would total canola acres could be. And we had it at, I think it was around 18 million because of crop rotations and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously it's gone beyond that, mm-hmm. Which is pretty phenomenal. So hence the expansions of canola oil seed processing across Western Canada.
Was there a chance that crushing facility was not going to be located in Saskatchewan? It could have gone...
There was. There was a location in Manitoba, location in Saskatchewan, yeah. and one in the U.S.
Yeah.
And, you know, ultimately, Yorkton was the best from a sourcing perspective, from a canola perspective. That's why it made mm-hmm. the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
But the U.S. was very aggressive in terms of giving incentives, mm-hmm. Which they typically are. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it wouldn't have been a good location. Yorkton was a great location.
What year was that?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I'm thinking it was 2003 yeah. or 5. It was interesting because Louis Dreyfus actually announced before we had board approval. And so then there was a lot of debate whether this was the right thing to do and mm-hmm. Could that community support two facilities. And again, in the analysis that we did, we said, well, regardless of whether Louis Dreyfus goes through or not, we'll be able to outcompete them mm-hmm. based on our origination that we had in our facilities.
And infrastructure too, with the yeah. amount of Pioneer elevators throughout the province.
Yeah,
right
exactly.
Yeah. And the reason I asked that is we've kind of went through a bit of a hiatus with new crushers coming on board. And mm-hmm. now we're, you know, 2023, and I think we've got 3, if not 4, coming online here within the next
yeah.
5 or 6 years. So, I mean, obviously the capacity of the province has now really overshot where even you guys were projecting. Right?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And the interesting part that I kind of liked about being at Richardson as well is I got involved in leading the sales and marketing for the food side of the business, so mm-hmm. Which went into retail. As well as food service. So get, you know, an opportunity to work with the Loblaws of the world's mm-hmm. Superstores, Cisco's on the food service side. And it's a different experience for sure.
Hmm. So you're involved right from the purchase of the canola through the crush all the way to selling a jug of oil at the grocery store.
Yeah, exactly.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So what transpired then to bring you eventually to AGI where you are today?
Yeah. So I left Richardson and went to a small biotech company for 3 years. And that was human biotech. It was plasma based, based out of Winnipeg and really great company, small company, publicly traded. They got bought out. And so after those 3 years, I had an opportunity to come to AGI. I met with Gary Anderson, who is the founder, one of the founders and CEO. Mm-hmm. And it was for a business development position. And we sat down and chatted for a couple of hours. hit it off really well. Mm-hmm. He said, well, we have this other guy that we have in mind for business development, but I'd really like to bring you on as our marketing or something. We got a lot of stuff to do.
Yeah.
And so I started about 2 months later, at the same time as Tim Close, who ultimately became CEO for Ag Growth for a while. So he and I started at the same time. And I started in marketing and then quickly took over sales and did some other things.
Moved your way up.
Yeah. And
how long ago was that?
That was in 2012. Mm. So in 2012, we were about a $300 million company. And in 2012, if you remember, some of you young guys might not, but if you remember, there was a drought. So I'd been out of the ag business for about 3 years and never really worried about weather. Right.
Yeah.
And then 2012, I start back up in, it was like the first week of July, right after the July long weekend. And we're in the boardroom and, Gary's like, well, guys, we got a drought. We're gonna have to cut back. We're, you know, anytime a drought happens, mm-hmm. it's about an 18-month hit to our business, mm-hmm. You know, start cutting expenses, cutting everything. And I'm like, oh my God, what have I gotten myself?
The timing. Great timing.
Walked right into it.
Does this mean I'm getting cut?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. What would you say has been one of the most successful acquisitions AGI has been involved with?
Yeah. Well, two of them would be on the top of my list. Yeah. One is Westeel for our Canadian business, for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah.
That really changed the landscape of who AGI is. Yeah. Through that acquisition and it was probably more than what we wanted to pay at the time. But ultimately it was the right decision for our business and again, changed the landscape of who AGI is in the Canadian business. And then the second one, was when we acquired Global out of Nebraska. And with Global came the Nico dryers, who mm-hmm. Flamin's, you know, sells a lot of Nico dryers, and we appreciate that. Mm. And it was new for us in Canada because we hadn't sold dryers in Canada, so that was great. Mm-hmm. We had the Hutchinson portable handling and permanent handling lines, which was really good for us and solidified even more of a position in our portable business in the U.S., they had bin manufacturing and handling equipment as well out of Grand Island, Nebraska. So it allowed us to get a bigger footprint. We were already selling in the U.S., but just on the fringes in the northern states. So it allowed us to mm-hmm. have a bit of a beachhead to build out our storage business in the U.S. And then with that came a company called Sentinel, which was building products. And so that was kind of the sleeper on the side, which actually over the last 4 or 5 years have been just phenomenal, mm-hmm. business for us. So
like it's for an ag market or
yeah,
what?
It's, really? It's sheds.
Like farm sheds.
Farm sheds.
Yep.
Yep.
Interesting. And just in the US though, right?
Just in the US. Yeah. Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I'd say those two acquisitions were really, game changers. And I guess going back to the Westeel one, which it was an added bonus for us outside of Canada, is they had Westeel at the time had a 50% stake in a company called Frame, which was a bin business in Italy. Mm-hmm. And so we after that acquisition, about a year after, we acquired the last 50%, and that allowed us to have again a beachhead for bin manufacturing and handling equipment in Europe. And so we've been very successful in terms of growing out that business. Mm-hmm. As you know, or you may or may not know, in the past we used to do quite a bit of business in the Ukraine and Russia. That's off now for the time. Ukraine may come back hopefully at some point in time. But they've been doing a lot of business in Africa, in North Africa in particular.
I'm curious where you see agriculture going. That's pretty wide. You could answer mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. however you want. Mm-hmm. And then I'm interested in knowing what you think agriculture is missing.
Okay. Well, first of all, I've experienced significant opportunities in agriculture, And I continue to see a vision where there's more opportunity in agriculture. And I think when you look at it, you know, and you look at, in particular, the technology that's out there and how, as consumers, you know, we have different experiences when we're purchasing things and looking for products and things like that, that in the ag business, we're just not there yet. Like, we just haven't taken that step of really, you know, getting to a customer experience that is what they would expect when they're dealing with Amazon or Costco or purchasing a vehicle. And so there's a long way to go for us as dealers and as manufacturers to improve that customer experience. So I see a ton of opportunity there. In terms of agriculture itself and for the farm, I think automation will really determine the next phase of growth for producers. Automation technology, whether that's gene technology or biologicals or whatever that looks like, we'll continue to innovate. We'll continue to feed a growing world, which we need to, and we'll continue to have different jobs available on the farm that are different than what we do today. Labor, as you guys know, just in your own business, is difficult to come by, and you've likely heard from your customers, producers, that it's difficult to find labor. And it's not hard to say, like, it's, you know, you're in the middle of a rural area, and a lot of young people don't want to live in the middle of a rural area anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. They want to be in an urban center. And so I think technology is going to facilitate how we can get people working in agriculture remotely. And possibly, you know, in a way that's like working from home, where they only have to be out at the farm once a week instead of every single day for things to get done. I think that is the vision of where things will need to go if agriculture is going to be sustainable, because you just won't have the workforce available.
Yeah. I think you nail it when you say technology will change, maybe not solve, but it will definitely change the void in labor. I remember when dealing with customers 15 years ago, and we talked about, back then it was called an LMO, a labor market opinion. Now it's called an LMIA. And what that is for when you have to immigrate help. So it's the paperwork that allows people to come work in
our foreign country. Farm labor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was becoming a pretty common thing. And that was 15 years ago. Yeah. And now you look at, like, equipment can do a lot of the stuff. You get bigger combines, you get bigger drills, you get bigger things so that there's less people to do it. We put up grain handling system, so it's, you know, one less, and you put a pit in so that you don't need as many trucks going. Like, you're really buying time is what you're doing. You're investing in infrastructure to save you time.
Yep.
And I think that'll continue, honestly, for a long time. When these autonomous tractors come out, that is definitely a love-hate relationship. And then you're going to put an electric autonomous tractor in there, which is whatever. Like, that technology, I think, is always going to continue to change and move the needle on the one thing, which is always going to be labor in rural areas, because that is where the dirt is to grow these needed crops, right? So
the other side of that too is, I think we all play a part, whether it be manufacturer or retailers, doesn't matter. I mean, you're a kid from North Saskatoon, grew up in a urban environment, and you ended up in the ag industry. We do have to find a way to bridge that gap so that you know, urban kids view agriculture as a legitimate career opportunity, whether that be via scholarships or whatever that looks like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I don't see how we survive without.
Yeah, well, you know what's interesting is the Farming Simulator game. Right? I think it's gotten kids kind of into it, and I don't think that's that far away in terms of what farming could potentially be in the future.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Remotely managing or monitoring different automated processes. Yeah, for sure.
John Deere made a statement about 7-8 years ago, and it always stuck with me. And, you know, you talk about Farm Simulator and they kind of showed how this all needs to be developed. And they said, we are no longer an equipment manufacturer. We are a technology manufacturer.
Right.
And that's their mentality. It's not just about the bearings and the shafts. It's about the electronics and the sensors and everything that allows you to do a lot of this work from a remote location or allow the machine to do the work for themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're to look into your crystal ball, when AGI comes around to their next round of acquisitions, do you think that they're going to start looking more into the technology stuff than into the hardware stuff?
I would say that if the opportunity were there on the technology and it was a nice fit with the improvement of our current equipment, that could be the case. I think it's a bit of a long shot. I believe that where we'll focus is a vertical integration of our business into the food side of the business, look for opportunities in terms of building out a bigger portfolio of food infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for joining us, Paul. Today, our guest was Paul Brisbois, the Senior Vice President of Ag Growth International. For Mitch Flamin, Regan Kuntz, I'm Trevor Grundy, and thank you for listening to Flamin Connect.